What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Now we are joined by Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst who directs the new internationalism project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's the author. Well, her latest book is Understanding Palestine and Israel. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good morning. Good to be with you, Kat.
Good to have you, Phyllis. I was going to start actually with conditions later in the interview, but I feel like a segue from the tape from Rami that we just heard is to bring in the fact that it's flooding right now in Gaza and has been for 3 days now. What does that mean for people living in bombed out buildings and in makeshift tents? How does it exacerbate the conditions that they were already in?
You know, we heard just a bit of this from Rami about the disaster. The rains come every winter in Gaza. It's very, very cold. Gaza, it's a desert, but it gets very, very cold in the winter. You get winds off the ocean. And the reality is what we have to keep in mind, this isn't just about weather. This is about the fact that this tiny little Gaza Strip, which we always used to talk about as one of the most crowded pieces of land on earth, has now been divided into two. The Israeli military controls 53% of Gaza. 47% is where 95% of the population is living. So the entire population that's left, which is close to 2 million people, are now living in half the Gaza Strip. So imagine the crowding. Virtually all buildings have been destroyed. 90% of residents have been terribly damaged or completely destroyed. And what people are living with is either they're living in the open, under the rain, with nothing, or the lucky ones have tents. The tents are made from nylon, which is just being torn apart in the wind and the rain. And we heard from a woman just now about how her tent is shredded, the rain comes in and destroys the mattresses that they have that are lying on the ground for their children, and their clothes. There's no way to dry them. There's no way to get dry clothes. So the images of this are horrific. This isn't just, oh, it's raining outside. What do? We have to stay inside. There is no safe inside. The tents are not lasting. These were cheap tents that were not ever designed to be used for years on a daily basis to be the only shelter that families have. So the question of the weather is something that will lead to far more people dying of hypothermia, of the inability to get out to get food. Newborn babies are being, if they're able to be born in one of the few hospitals that has a little bit of capacity left, about a quarter of Gaza's hospitals are still functioning partly. And if they were lucky enough to have their baby born in a hospital, the women are sent home immediately because there's no space in the hospitals for them to stay there. And they're nobody expects it, but they're faced with having to try to take care of a newborn infant in the cold and the wet in a shredded tent. So that's what we're really looking at here when we talk about the conditions inside. This so-called ceasefire also is not a ceasefire. It never has been. It was a reduce fire. And the Israelis continue to violate even that. It is true, fewer people are being killed by Israeli bombs, Israeli tanks, Israeli guns than were being killed on a daily basis before the ceasefire. And that's important. We can't pretend that the difference between 100, 125, 150 people being killed every day, whereas now we have 10 or 20 or maybe 50 people being killed in a day. That's better. That's maybe 50, 60, 70 lives being not stolen from us every day, but that's a far cry from a ceasefire. We don't have a ceasefire. We have these dramatically decreasing levels of access to food, to clean water. Any of these things are simply not getting in. They're not being distributed. The key organizations that are asking the Israelis on a daily basis for permits to bring in more of the supplies that are sitting literally outside the gates that remain closed, the gates into Gaza. So this is something that Israel is doing deliberately, consciously, and the result is more starvation, more inability of the children particularly, who are particularly vulnerable, as well as the elders, who are facing the possibility of the outcome of now months of of hunger are facing the inability to be treated. The hospitals don't have either the specially treated food biscuits. They don't have medicine. They don't have anything that they need. So the situation is one of complete disaster while we're being told that there's a ceasefire underway. The implication being that, oh, everything's okay now. Nothing is okay now. And there is no real ceasefire.
I think you answered this in part. To put numbers to your point, at least 266 people have been murdered and 635 wounded since October 10th. And yet you see many global powers, including Germany, who just lifted its arms restrictions for whatever that was worth, say things have stabilized in the region. I don't know if you want to expound any more than you already have on the dangers of that narrative.
Yeah, I think that this is leading to a number of things, the most important being the actual impact on Palestinians in Gaza right now. But as you say, Kat, the diplomatic results of something like this, this discourse that implies that things are better, things are okay, we're looking forward now, we're looking to the future, we're not looking to the past. People are living in the same as the past, and that's not being taken into account. It was always a very uncertain reality when Germany announced, I think it was about 3 months ago, that they would stop providing weapons to Israel. That was huge because while the US provides 70% of all the weapons and the bombs, everything that Israel is using to kill Palestinians in Gaza, 28% was being provided by Germany. So when Germany announced that they would no longer do that, that was a huge, important announcement. It was never clear whether they were going to abide by it or not. And I frankly don't have good information on whether they did. But it was important that they said it, not least because Germany, for all the historical reasons going back to the Holocaust, had been the country in Europe, in the European Union and in Europe more broadly, that was the least willing to criticize Israel, to hold Israel accountable. So when they suddenly did and said, this is not acceptable behavior, we're going to stop sending weapons, that was huge because it freed up a few other countries that might have been thinking about changing their policies to one demanding accountability in some form, but were resisting that, were reluctant to do it. They didn't want the U.S. to accuse them of anti-Semitism. All of those considerations affect governments as well as people. So now when Germany says officially, we're going to lift that restriction, whatever the restriction actually was. This is a devastating blow to the effort to create actual accountability. So far, none of the diplomatic moves that are being discussed, not the UN resolution that's being voted on today
We'll go there.
at the Security Council, not any of the discussions have included any level of accountability for the Israeli forces that have carried out what the many UN agencies, the International Court of Justice has said that this is plausibly genocide. And yet there has been no effort to build on the question of accountability at the global level. So this kind of a statement, this kind of using this narrative of things are better now, we're moving forward, this is devastatingly dangerous for people's lives. People will die as a result of these kinds of false claims that are being made.
You pulled out a thread I hadn't thought about, actually, quite frankly. And that is, like, normally, air quotes, there's nothing normal about any of this. When we get to this point, right, a genocide has happened, we get to this point, we're talking about peace, et cetera, that accountability piece is in there. People have to be taken to account. We just heard about the sheikh that just is sentenced to death for her role in genocide. Not here, though. Without accountability, what kind of actual path forward? I mean, I've got lots of questions about the path forward, but no accountability, then we just pretend this didn't happen.
Essentially, yes, it means that Israel gets a pass because what we're talking about now, the major diplomatic initiative, the one that's being voted on today at the Security Council, is this Trump 20-point process that is designed for Trump's interests, including his own personal and family interests, which goes certainly beyond this to the Saudi and Qatari and UAE relationships, the fact that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia will be coming to Washington in the next few days to meet with Trump, with those long-standing economic ties there. But what we're looking at here is a moment when what is desperately needed is a complete arms embargo, meaning not just shipping, stop the shipment of arms, but stop allowing ships to be used to transmit those arms, stop allowing them to be part of the global shipping networks. All of that has to happen at the global level. And indeed, the resolution passed by the UN General Assembly last September of 2024, called for restrictions on arms, including all of those things. So we have the laws in place for that, but implementation of it requires us. Implementation of international law, including accountability, can only happen when people around the world challenge their own governments to make this real. The governments simply are not going to do it on their own. And the question of the arms embargo and the question of accountability, in my view, are the two most important aspects of what it's going to take to end this genocide. It's not going to just wither away. It's going to continue as it has. The genocide is not over. The genocide is continuing because the intention is still there. The intention is still there and the actions are still there. The actions that the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, ordered Israel to stop doing almost 2 years ago when it found that Israel's actions plausibly may constitute genocide, and that whatever the title, those actions are illegal and must be stopped immediately. That was their order in January of 2024. That's getting on towards 2 years ago. And that's what has not been happening. There has not been that kind of enforcement. I don't think that the resolution is going to pass in the Security Council today. It's a resolution that does not call for protection of the Palestinians. It calls for a so-called stabilization force, not a protection force, whose early mandate was described as protecting Egypt and Israel from anything bad that might happen in Gaza, which means stopping any form of Palestinian resistance to the ongoing assault.
Can I pause you there, Phyllis? Because we were going to go to the plan next, and there's two parts of it that I want you to help us better understand. And one of them is the International Stabilization Force, known as the ISF. Its title alone, knowing what I know about political history, makes me like cringe. That they're supposed to take responsibility over from the Israeli Defense Forces. Who makes up the ISF? Who is that?
Well, this is one of the big questions. The U.S. has said this is a challenge that we face. Which countries are going to provide soldiers? And are they going to be soldiers? Are they going to be police? Are they going to be armed? With what level of armaments? None of that is clear. Some countries, including, for example, Indonesia, has said that under certain conditions, they would provide 20,000 troops. That's a lot of foreign occupiers, right? And the problem is they haven't said exactly what those conditions are. They seem to be saying that depending on when Hamas is disarmed. Well, that's another challenge because it's not clear who is supposed to disarm Hamas. Israel, God knows, has been trying to do that for 2 years, have killed an awful lot of people and have not succeeded in, quote, disarming Hamas. Hamas has made clear it is prepared to negotiate on the question, for example, of the decommissioning of major weapons, their rockets, for example, however many left they have, doesn't seem to be very many, but that they would decommission major weapons. But that's very different than asking individual fighters who have been trying to protect their people, their own families. Remember, the Hamas fighters are from Gaza. This is not some foreign force that came in to invade. These are people from Gaza who are trying to protect their families. They have not been able to, clearly. And they did lead the attack of October 7th, 2023. And what we're seeing now is a scenario where the whole question of what does disarmament look like? Hamas has said they're willing to negotiate, but nobody is talking to them. Hamas diplomats are not being present in any of the negotiations. They're not addressing the UN Security Council to talk about how this might go forward. So what we're actually looking at is that this so-called stabilization force and the so-called peace board, which is to be led by one Donald Trump, and the CEO of which is to be led by somebody named Tony Blair, a team that may sound familiar in terms of the governments they represent or represented back during the Iraq War, of running a foreign occupation of Gaza. It will not be only Israeli troops, although there's no indication that they will be leaving. They may move around within the strip, maybe to make the current 47% of where Palestinians are allowed to be slightly more. Maybe they'll make it 57%. We don't know. What we do know is there's nothing that requires them to actually get out, to give the Palestinians not only their freedom from the presence of U.S. troops on the ground shooting at them, but the right to control their own destiny, their own national rights, to control their own water, their own seaports, their own skies. None of that will be available to Palestinians. Control of their own borders, allowing who goes in, who goes out. None of that is to be allowed. Nobody's even talking about that. That's not even on anyone's agenda. So what we're looking at here is the continuation of what used to be the post-World War I mandate process of the then League of Nations handing out mandates, colonial control of territories all around the world to various countries. In return, we now see, you know, decades and decades later, the United Nations being asked to vote on a return to that same mandate process, where the Security Council is being asked to give the UN imprimatur to a foreign occupation run by the United States, staffed by soldiers from some other countries, but continuing to deny the Palestinians their freedom, their rights, their national rights, their individual rights, their human rights. No equality, none of those things are even on the agenda.
I got one more question for you, Phyllis Bennis, before I let you go. And cause I want to touch on briefly sort of the kerfluffle that's happening in the right wing, the ultra right wing sector in the Israeli government. Netanyahu and they have said absolutely no Palestinian statehood. They don't support the plan because of this very vague sentence about if this and if that, then maybe perhaps there's a possibility that.
Right. We could look at a state.
Right, maybe. We'll see. Additionally, members of the Netanyahu's right-wing government are threatening to leave the government over both that, and also they say that Netanyahu has not issued the promised response to countries like France, who said that they recognized a Palestinian statehood. You and I have already talked about why that was too little too late, but still it pissed them off. So I guess I'm wondering a couple of things. Your thoughts about the fractures. I mean, they've been ongoing, but it seems like they're getting larger. What happens if they dip before next year's election? What does that mean for Netanyahu, who's already in the midst of so much scandal and courts and blah?
Yeah, it's very unclear, actually, what it would mean. The sense earlier was that Netanyahu was completely dependent on the far right, the fascist right component of his very right-wing government. I mean, this is a government of the right, the far right, the extreme right, and the fascist right. I mean, that's the range of where it goes. There are indications that the farthest right elements, the fascist right elements, who, if they made good on that threat to leave the government, might not lead to the fall of the government, because there are some aspects of the so-called opposition which do not necessarily oppose much of what has been done in the last 2 years in Gaza, but have certain disagreements over certain tactical things, that they might protect the government, keep it in power, not vote it out of office, not follow a withdrawal of the far right from it with a motion for a vote of no confidence, for instance, and leading to a new government. So it's not very clear. The Netanyahu's support seems to be diminished just a bit. But it may be that in that context, he may not be as vulnerable to his farthest right current supporters as he has been before. So it's still a bit of a mystery how that would play out. But this notion of opposing the creation of a Palestinian state, on the one hand, he doesn't have to worry too much because it's not seriously on the agenda. The other thing that we have to keep in mind, looking at this in the context of the last 35 years of so-called peace process, it was never about two actual states. Actual states implies control of borders, control of entry and exit, control of the economy, control of the skies, control of water, control of the electrical grid, all of those things. None of those things were ever considered part of the so-called Palestinian state that was under consideration through all the years of the Oslo process. What was under consideration was one state, Israel, most powerful military force in the region, the only nuclear state, nuclear armed state in the region, all those things, versus a non-state entity, more or less comparable to the Bantustans of apartheid South Africa, where there would be something resembling municipal authority for somebody to control who sweeps the streets and how long are the stores open during the day, those sorts of municipal questions, and everything else would be under continuing Israeli occupation. Now we're looking at the same thing, only instead of an Israeli occupation, it would be an international occupation. We know that there are already U.S. troops on the edge of Gaza, 200 of them, in the coordinating center, as it's being called, and some of them have entered Gaza for particular tasks. That's a small step from having U.S. troops actually be part of the occupying forces. All of the rhetoric about no boots on the ground, well, it might not be boots, it might be sneakers, you know, these might be CIA types, so we don't know. But the possibility of direct U.S. intervention is certainly on the agenda. The rest of it is perhaps from other countries, but fundamentally does not change the fact that Palestinians of Gaza, and particularly the escalation that we're seeing in the West Bank as well, just today in the West Bank, the IDF killed a 15-year-old child and so far has refused to return their body to their parents. So this escalation in the West Bank could mean a very similar situation as what we're seeing right now in Gaza. Without a much continuing movement, the kind of extraordinary movement we've seen in the U.S. and around the world, to demand that governments abide by the conditions set by the International Court of Justice and put forward in a resolution passed by a huge majority of the General Assembly of the UN. Without that, we're not going to see any change in the reality of Palestinians continuing to live under occupation.
Phyllis Bennis, I always learned so much from you. Thank you so much for coming on the show and for all of your work. Talk again soon.
Thank you, Kat. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.